of space itself. The pull of the force is actually the push created when he walks over a fold in the paper. In other words, gravity does not pull. Space pushes. By 1915, Einstein was finally able to complete what he called the general theory of relativity, which has since become the architecture upon which all of cosmology is based. In this startling new picture, gravity was not an independent force filling the universe, but the apparent effect of the bending of the fabric of space-time. His theory was so powerful that he could summarize it in an equation about an inch long. In this brilliant new theory, the amount of bending of space and time was determined by the amount of matter and energy it contained. Think of throwing a rock into a pond, which creates a series of ripples emanating from the impact. The larger the rock, the more the warping of the surface of the pond. Similarly, the larger the star, the more the bending of space-time surrounding the star. The birth of cosmology. Einstein tried to use this picture to describe the universe as a whole. Unknown to him, he would have to face Bentley's paradox, formulated centuries earlier. In the 1920s, most astronomers believed that the universe was uniform and static. So Einstein started by assuming that the universe was filled uniformly with dust and stars. In one model, the universe could be compared to a large balloon or bubble. We live on the skin of the bubble. The stars and galaxies that we see surrounding us can be compared to dots painted on the surface of the balloon. To his surprise, whenever he tried to solve his equations, he found that the universe became dynamic. Einstein faced the same problem identified by Bentley over 200 years earlier. Since gravity is always attractive, never repulsive, a finite collection of stars should collapse into a fiery cataclysm. This, however, contradicted the prevailing wisdom of the early 20th century, which stated that the universe was static and uniform. As revolutionary as Einstein was, he could not believe that the universe could be in motion. Like Newton and legions of others, Einstein believed in a static universe. So in 1917, Einstein was forced to introduce a new term into his equations, a fudge factor that produced a new force into his theory, an anti-gravity force that pushed the stars apart. Einstein called this the cosmological constant, an ugly duckling that seemed like an afterthought to Einstein's theory. Einstein then arbitrarily chose this anti-gravity to cancel precisely the attraction of gravity, creating a static universe. In other words, the universe became static by fiat. The inward contraction of the universe due to gravity was cancelled by the outward force of dark energy. For 70 years, this anti-gravity force was considered to be something of an orphan until the discoveries of the last few years. In 1917, the Dutch physicist Willem de Sitter produced another solution to Einstein's theory, one in which the universe was infinite but was completely devoid of any matter. In fact, it consisted only of energy contained in the vacuum, the cosmological constant. This pure anti-gravity force was sufficient to drive a rapid exponential expansion of the universe. Even without matter, this dark energy could create an expanding universe. Physicists were now faced with a dilemma. Einstein's universe had matter, but no motion. De Sitter's universe had motion, but no matter. In Einstein's universe, the cosmological constant was necessary to neutralize the attraction of gravity and create a static universe. In de Sitter's universe, the cosmological constant alone was sufficient to create an expanding universe. Finally, in 1919, when Europe was trying to dig its way out of the rubble and carnage of World War I, teams of astronomers were sent around the world to test Einstein's new theory. Einstein had earlier proposed that the curvature of space-time by the sun would be sufficient to bend starlight that is passing in its vicinity. starlight should bend around the sun in a precise, calculable way, similar to the way glass bends light. But since the brilliance of sun's light masks any stars during the day, scientists would have to wait for an eclipse of the sun to make the decisive experiment. A group led by British astrophysicist Arthur Eddington sailed to the island of Principe in the Gulf of Guinea off the coast of West Africa to record the bending of starlight around the sun during the next solar eclipse. Another team, led by Andrew Crommelin, set sail to Sobral in northern Brazil. The data they gathered indicated an average deviation of starlight to be 1.79 arc seconds, which confirmed Einstein's prediction of 1.74 arc seconds to within experimental error. In other words, light did bend near the sun. Eddington later claimed that verifying Einstein's theory was the greatest moment in his life. On November 6, 1919, at a joint meeting of the Royal Society and the Royal Astronomical Society in London, Nobel laureate and Royal Society president J.J. Thompson said solemnly that this was one of the greatest achievements in the history of human thought. It is not the discovery of an outlying island, but of a whole continent of new scientific ideas. It is the greatest discovery in connection with gravitation since Newton enunciated his principles. According to legend, Eddington was later asked by a reporter, "There's a rumor that only three people in the entire world understand Einstein's theory. You must be one of them." Eddington stood in silence, so the reporter said, "Don't be modest, Eddington." Eddington shrugged and said, "Not at all. I was wondering who the third might be." The next day, the London Times splashed the headline, "Revolution in Science. New Theory of the Universe. Newton's Ideas Overthrown." The headline marked the moment when Einstein became a world-renowned figure, a messenger from the stars. So great was this announcement, and so radical was Einstein's departure from Newton, that it also caused a backlash, as distinguished physicists and astronomers denounced the theory. At Columbia University, Charles Lane Poor, a professor of celestial mechanics, led the criticism of relativity, saying, "I feel as if I had been wandering with Alice in Wonderland and had tea with the Mad Hatter." The reason that relativity violates our common sense is not that relativity is wrong, but that our common sense does not represent reality. We are the oddballs of the universe. We inhabit an unusual piece of real estate where temperatures, densities, and velocities are quite mild. However, in the real universe, temperatures can be blisteringly hot in the center of stars or numbingly cold in outer space, and subatomic particles zipping through space regularly travel near light speed. In other words, our common sense evolved in a highly unusual, obscure part of the universe, Earth. It is not surprising that our common sense fails to grasp the true universe. The problem lies not in relativity, but in assuming that our common sense represents reality. The future of the universe. Although Einstein's theory was successful in explaining astronomical phenomena, such as the bending of starlight around the sun and the slight wobbling of the orbit of the planet Mercury, its cosmological predictions were still confusing. Matters were greatly clarified by the Russian physicist Alexander Friedmann, who found the most general and realistic solutions of Einstein's equations. Even today, they are taught in every graduate course in general relativity. He discovered them in 1922, but he died in 1925, and his work was largely forgotten until years later. Normally, Einstein's theory consists of a series of extraordinarily difficult equations, which often require a computer to solve. However, Friedmann assumed that the universe was dynamic and then made two simplifying assumptions called the cosmological principle, that the universe is isotropic, it looks the same no matter where we look from a given point, and that the universe is homogeneous. It is uniform no matter where you go in the universe. Under these two simplifying assumptions, we find that these equations collapse. In fact, both Einstein's and de Sitter's solutions were special cases of Friedmann's more general solution. Remarkably, his solutions depend on just three parameters. 1. H, which determines the rate of expansion of the universe. Today, this is called Hubble's constant, named after the astronomer who actually measured the expansion of the universe. 2. Omega, which measures the average density of matter in the universe. 3. Lambda, the energy associated with empty space, or dark energy. Many cosmologists have spent their entire professional careers trying to nail down the precise value of these three numbers. The subtle interplay between these three constants determines the future evolution of the entire universe. For example, since gravity attracts, the density of the universe omega acts as a kind of brake to slow the expansion of the universe, reversing some of the effects of the Big Bang's rate of expansion. Think of throwing a rock into the air. Normally, gravity is strong enough to reverse the direction of the rock, which then tumbles back to Earth. However, if one throws the rock fast enough, then it can escape Earth's gravity and soar into outer space forever. Like a rock, the universe originally expanded because of the Big Bang, but matter, or omega, acts as a brake on the expansion of the universe, in the same way that Earth's gravity acts as a brake on the rock. For the moment, let's assume that lambda, the energy associated with empty space, equals zero. Let omega be the density of the universe divided by the critical density. The critical density of the universe is approximately 10 hydrogen atoms per cubic meter. To appreciate how empty the universe is, the critical density of the universe corresponds to finding a single hydrogen atom within the volume of 3 basketballs, on average. If omega is less than 1, scientists conclude that there is not enough matter in the universe to reverse the original expansion from the Big Bang. Like throwing the rock in the air, if Earth's mass is not great enough, the rock will eventually leave Earth. As a result, the universe will expand forever, eventually plunging the universe into a big freeze until temperatures approach absolute zero. This is the principle behind a refrigerator or air conditioner. When gas expands, it cools down. In your air conditioner, for example, gas circulating in a pipe expands, cooling the pipe and your room. If omega is greater than 1, then there is sufficient matter and gravity in the universe to ultimately reverse the cosmic expansion. As a result, the expansion of the universe will come to a halt, and the universe will begin to contract. Like the rock thrown in the air, if Earth's mass is great enough, the rock will eventually reach a maximum height and then come tumbling back to Earth. Temperatures will begin to soar as the stars and galaxies rush toward each other. Anyone who has ever inflated a bicycle tire knows that the compression of gas creates heat. The mechanical work of pumping air is converted into heat energy. In the same way, the compression of the universe converts gravitational energy into heat energy. Eventually, temperatures would become so hot that all life would be extinguished as the universe heads toward a fiery big crunch. Astronomer Ken Crosswell labels this process from creation to cremation. A third possibility is that omega is perched precisely at 1. In other words, the density of the universe equals the critical density, in which case the universe hovers between the two extremes but will still expand forever. This scenario, we will see, is favored by the inflationary picture. And last, there is the possibility that the universe, in the aftermath of a big crunch, can reemerge into a new Big Bang. This theory is referred to as the oscillating universe. Friedman showed that each of these scenarios, in turn, determines the curvature of space-time. If omega is less than one and the universe expands forever, Friedman showed that not only is time infinite, but space is infinite as well. The universe is said to be open, that is, infinite in both space and time. When Friedman computed the curvature of this universe, he found it to be negative. This is like the surface of a saddle or a trumpet. If a bug lived on the surface of this surface, it would find that parallel lines never meet, and the interior angles of a triangle sum up to less than 180 degrees. If omega is larger than one, then the universe will eventually contract into a big crunch. Time and space are finite. Friedman found that the curvature of this universe is positive, like a sphere. Finally, if omega equals one, then space is flat, and both time and space are unbounded. Not only did Friedman provide the first comprehensive approach to Einstein's cosmological equations, he also gave the most realistic conjecture about doomsday, the ultimate fate of the universe, whether it will perish in a big freeze, fry in a big crunch, or oscillate forever. The answer depends upon the crucial parameters, the density of the universe, and the energy of the vacuum. But Friedman's picture left a gaping hole. If the universe is expanding, then it means that it might have had a beginning. Einstein's theory said nothing about the instant of this beginning. What was missing was the moment of creation, the Big Bang. And three scientists would eventually give us a most compelling picture of the Big Bang. Chapter 3. The Big Bang. The universe is not only queerer than we suppose, it is queerer than we can suppose. J.B.S. Haldane. What we humans are looking for in a creation story is a way of experiencing the world that will open to us the transcendent, that informs us and at the same time forms ourselves within it. That is what people want. This is what the soul asks for. Joseph Campbell. The cover of Time magazine on March 6, 1995, showing the great spiral galaxy M100, claimed, "Cosmology is in chaos." Cosmology was being thrown into turmoil because the latest data from the Hubble Space Telescope seemed to indicate that the universe was younger than its oldest star, a scientific impossibility. The data indicated that the universe was between 8 billion and 12 billion years old, while some believed the oldest star to be as much as 14 billion years old. "You can't be older than your ma," quipped Christopher Impey of the University of Arizona. But once you read the fine print, you realized that the theory of the Big Bang is quite healthy. The evidence disproving the Big Bang theory was based on a single galaxy, M100, which is a dubious way of conducting science. The loopholes were, as the article acknowledged, big enough to drive the Starship Enterprise through. Based on the Hubble Space Telescope's rough data, the age of the universe could not be calculated to better than 10% to 20% accuracy. My point is that the Big Bang theory is not based on speculation, but on hundreds of data points taken from several different sources, each of which converge to support a single, self-consistent theory. In science, not all theories are created equal. While anyone is free to propose their own version of the creation of the universe, it should be required that it explain the hundreds of data points we have collected that are consistent with the Big Bang theory. The three great proofs of the Big Bang theory are based on the work of three larger-than-life scientists who dominated their respective fields: Edwin Hubble, George Gamow, and Fred Hoyle. Edwin Hubble, patrician astronomer. While the theoretical foundation of cosmology was laid by Einstein, modern observational cosmology was almost single-handedly created by Edwin Hubble, who was perhaps the most important astronomer of the 20th century. Born in 1889 in the backwoods of Marshfield, Missouri, Hubble was a modest country boy with high ambitions. His father, a lawyer and insurance agent, urged him to pursue a career in law. Hubble, however, was enthralled by the books of Jules Verne and enchanted by the stars. He devoured science fiction classics like 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea and From the Earth to the Moon. He was also an accomplished boxer. Promoters wanted him to turn professional and fight the world heavyweight champion Jack Johnson. He won a prestigious Rhodes Scholarship to study law at Oxford, where he began to adopt the mannerisms of British upper-crust society. He started wearing tweed suits, smoking a pipe, adopting a distinguished British accent, and speaking of his dueling scars, which were rumored to be self-inflicted. Hubble, however, was unhappy. What really motivated him was not torts and lawsuits. His romance was with the stars, one that had started when he was a child. He bravely switched careers and headed for the University of Chicago and the observatory at Mount Wilson, California, which then housed the largest telescope on Earth with a 100-inch mirror. Starting so late in his career, Hubble was a man in a hurry. To make up for lost time, he rapidly set out to answer some of the deepest, most enduring mysteries in astronomy. In the 1920s, the universe was a comfortable place. It was widely believed that the entire universe consisted of just the Milky Way galaxy, the hazy swath of light that cuts across the night sky resembling spilt milk. The word galaxy, in fact, comes from the Greek word for milk. In 1920, the great debate took place between astronomers Harlow Shapley of Harvard and Heber Curtis of Lick Observatory. Entitled The Scale of the Universe, it concerned the size of the Milky Way galaxy and the universe itself. Shapley took the position that the Milky Way made up the entire visible universe. Curtis believed that beyond the Milky Way lay the spiral nebulae, strange but beautiful wisps of swirling haze. As early as the 1700s, the philosopher Immanuel Kant had speculated that these nebulae were island universes. Hubble was intrigued by the debate. The key problem was that determining the distance to the stars is, and still remains, one of the most fiendishly difficult tasks in astronomy. A bright star that is very distant can look identical to a dim star that is close by. This confusion was the source of many great feuds and controversies in astronomy. Hubble needed a standard candle, an object that emits the same amount of light anywhere in the universe, to resolve the problem. A large part, in fact, of the effort in cosmology to this day consists of attempting to find and calibrate such standard candles. Many of the great debates in astronomy center around how reliable these standard candles really are. If one had a standard candle that burned uniformly with the same intensity throughout the universe, then a star that was 4 times dimmer than normal would simply be twice as far from Earth. One night, when analyzing a photograph of the spiral nebula Andromeda, Hubble had a eureka moment. What he found within Andromeda was a type of variable star, called a Cepheid, which had been studied by Henrietta Leavitt. It was known that this star regularly grew and dimmed with time, and the time for one complete cycle was correlated with its brightness. The brighter the star, the longer its cycle of pulsation. Thus, by simply measuring the length of this cycle, one could calibrate its brightness and hence determine its distance. Hubble found that it had a period of 31.4 days, which, much to his surprise, translated to a distance of 1,000,000 light-years, far outside the Milky Way galaxy. The Milky Way's luminous disk is only 100,000 light-years across. Later calculations would show that Hubble, in fact, underestimated the true distance to Andromeda, which is closer to 2,000,000 light-years away. When he performed the same experiment on other spiral nebulae, Hubble found that they too were well outside the Milky Way galaxy. In other words, it was clear to him that these spiral nebulae were entire island universes in their own right, that the Milky Way galaxy was just one galaxy in a firmament of galaxies. In one stroke, the size of the universe became vastly larger. From a single galaxy, the universe was suddenly populated with millions, perhaps billions, of sister galaxies. From a universe just 100,000 light-years across, the universe suddenly was perhaps billions of light-years across. That discovery alone would have guaranteed Hubble a place in the pantheon of astronomers, but he topped even that discovery. Not only was he determined to find the distance to the galaxies, he wanted to calculate how fast they moved as well. Doppler effect and the expanding universe. Hubble knew that the simplest way of calculating the speed of distant objects is to analyze the change in sound or light they emit, otherwise known as the Doppler effect. Cars make this sound as they pass us on the highway. Police use the Doppler effect to calculate your speed. They flash a laser beam onto your car, which reflects back to the police car. By analyzing the shift in frequency of the laser light, the police can calculate your velocity. If a star, for example, is moving toward you, the light waves it emits are squeezed like an accordion. As a result, its wavelength gets shorter. A yellow star will appear slightly bluish because the color blue has a shorter wavelength than yellow. Similarly, if a star is moving away from you, its light waves are stretched, giving it a longer wavelength, so that a yellow star appears slightly reddish. The greater the distortion, the greater the velocity of the star. Thus, if we know the shift in frequency of starlight, we can determine the star's speed. In 1912, astronomer Vesto Slipher had found that the galaxies were moving away from Earth at great velocity. Not only was the universe much larger than previously expected, it was also expanding and at great speed. Outside of small fluctuations, he found that the galaxies exhibited a red shift caused by galaxies moving away from us rather than a blue one. Slipher's discovery showed that the universe was indeed dynamic and not static, as Newton and Einstein had assumed. In all the centuries that scientists had studied the paradoxes of Bentley and Olbers, no one had seriously considered the possibility that the universe was expanding. In 1928, Hubble made a fateful trip to Holland to meet with Willem de Sitter. What intrigued Hubble was de Sitter's prediction that the farther away a galaxy is, the faster it should be moving. Think of an expanding balloon with galaxies marked on its surface. As the balloon expands, the galaxies that are close to each other move apart relatively slowly. The closer they are to each other, the slower they move apart. But galaxies that are farther apart on the balloon move apart much faster. De Sitter urged Hubble to look for this effect in his data, which could be verified by analyzing the redshift of the galaxies. The greater the redshift of a galaxy, the faster it was moving away, and hence the farther it should be. According to Einstein's theory, the redshift of a galaxy was not, technically speaking, caused by the galaxy speeding away from Earth. Instead, it was caused by the expansion of space itself between the galaxy and Earth. The origin of the redshift is that light emanating from a distant galaxy is stretched or lengthened by the expansion of space, and hence it appears reddened. Hubble's Law. When Hubble went back to California, he heeded de Sitter's advice and looked for evidence of this effect. By analyzing 24 galaxies, he found that the farther the galaxy was, the faster it was moving away from Earth, just as Einstein's equations had predicted. The ratio between the two, speed divided by distance, was roughly a constant. It quickly became known as Hubble's constant, or H. It is perhaps the single most important constant in all of cosmology, because Hubble's constant tells you the rate at which the universe is expanding. If the universe is expanding, scientists pondered, then perhaps it had a beginning as well. The inverse of the Hubble constant, in fact, gives a rough calculation of the age of the universe. Imagine a videotape of an explosion. In the videotape, we see the debris leaving the site of the explosion and can calculate the velocity of expansion. But this also means that we can run the videotape backward until all the debris collects into a single point. Since we know the velocity of expansion, we can roughly work backward and calculate the time at which the explosion took place. Hubble's original estimate put the age of the universe at about 1.8 billion years, which gave generations of cosmologists headaches because that was younger than the reputed age of Earth and the stars. Years later, astronomers realized that errors in measuring the light from the Cepheid variables in Andromeda had given an incorrect value of Hubble's constant. In fact, the Hubble wars concerning the precise value of the Hubble constant have raged for the past 70 years. The most definitive figure today comes from the WMAP satellite. In 1931, on Einstein's triumphant visit to the Mount Wilson Observatory, he first met Hubble. Realizing that the universe was indeed expanding, he called the cosmological constant his biggest blunder. However, even a blunder by Einstein is enough to shake the foundations of cosmology, as we will see in discussing the WMAP satellite data in later chapters. When Einstein's wife was shown around the Mammoth Observatory, she was told that the gigantic telescope was determining the ultimate shape of the universe. Mrs. Einstein replied nonchalantly, "My husband does that on the back of an old envelope." The Big Bang. A Belgian priest, Georges Lemaître, who learned of Einstein's theory, was fascinated by the idea that the theory logically led to a universe that was expanding and therefore had a beginning. Because gases heat up as they are compressed, he realized that the universe at the beginning of time must have been fantastically hot. In 1927, he stated that the universe must have started out as a superatom of incredible temperature and density, which suddenly exploded outward, giving rise to Hubble's expanding universe. He wrote, "The evolution of the world can be compared to a display of fireworks that has just ended. Some few red wisps, ashes, and smoke. Standing on a well-chilled cinder, we see the slow fading of the suns, and we try to recall the vanished brilliance of the origin of worlds." The first person to propose this idea of a superatom at the beginning of time was, once again, Edgar Allan Poe. He argued that matter attracts other forms of matter, therefore at the beginning of time there must have been a cosmic concentration of atoms. Lemaître would attend physics conferences and pester other scientists with his idea. They would listen to him with good humor and then quietly dismiss his idea. Arthur Eddington, one of the leading physicists of his time, said, "As a scientist, I simply do not believe that the present order of things started off with a bang. The notion of an abrupt beginning to this present order of nature is repugnant to me." But over the years, his persistence gradually wore down the resistance of the physics community. The scientist who would become the most important spokesman and popularizer of the Big Bang theory would eventually provide the most convincing proof of the theory. George Gamow, Cosmic Jester. While Hubble was the sophisticated patrician of astronomy, his work was continued by yet another larger-than-life figure, George Gamow. Gamow was in many respects his opposite, a jester, a cartoonist, famous for his practical jokes and his 20 books on science, many of them for young adults. Several generations of physicists, myself included, were raised on his entertaining and informative books about physics and cosmology. In a time when relativity and the quantum theory were revolutionizing science and society, His books stood alone. They were the only credible books on advanced science available to teenagers. While lesser scientists are often barren of ideas, content to merely grind through mountains of dry data, Gamow was one of the creative geniuses of his time, a polymath who rapidly spun off ideas that would change the course of nuclear physics, cosmology, and even DNA research. It was perhaps no accident that the autobiography of James Watson, who with Francis Crick unraveled the secret of the DNA molecule, was titled Genes, Gamow, and Girls. As his colleague Edward Teller recalled, 90% of Gamow's theories were wrong, and it was easy to recognize that they were wrong. But he didn't mind. He was one of those people who had no particular pride in any of his inventions. He would throw out his latest idea and then treat it as a joke. But the remaining 10% of his ideas would go on to change the entire scientific landscape. Gamow was born in Odessa, Russia, in 1904, during that country's early social upheavals. Gamow recalled that classes were often suspended when Odessa was bombarded by some enemy warship or when Greek, French, or British expeditionary forces staged a bayonet attack along the main streets of the city against entrenched white, red, or even green Russian forces, or when Russian forces of different colors fought one another. The turning point in his early life came when he went to church and secretly took home some communion bread after the service. Looking through a microscope, he could see no difference between the communion bread, representing the flesh of Jesus Christ, and ordinary bread. He concluded, "I think this was the experiment which made me a scientist." He was educated at the University of Leningrad and studied under physicist Alexander Friedmann. Later, at the University of Copenhagen, he met many of the giants of physics, like Niels Bohr. In 1932, he and his wife tried unsuccessfully to defect from the Soviet Union by sailing on a raft from Crimea to Turkey. Later, he succeeded in defecting while attending a physics conference in Brussels, which earned him a death sentence from the Soviets. Gamow was famous for sending limericks to his friends. Most are unprintable, but one limerick captures the anxieties cosmologists feel when they face the enormity of astronomical numbers and stare infinity in the face. "There was a young fellow from Trinity who took the square root of infinity, but the number of digits gave him the fidgets. He dropped math and took up divinity." In the 1920s in Russia, Gamow scored his first big success when he solved the mystery of why radioactive decay was possible. Thanks to the work of Madame Curie and others, scientists knew that the uranium atom was unstable and emitted radiation in the form of an alpha ray, the nucleus of a helium atom. But according to Newtonian mechanics, the mysterious nuclear force that held the nucleus together should have been a barrier that prevented this leakage. How was this possible? Gamow and R. W. Gurney and E. U. Condon realized that radioactive decay was possible because in the quantum theory, the uncertainty principle meant that one never knew precisely the location and velocity of a particle. Hence, there was a small probability that it might tunnel or penetrate right through a barrier. Today, this idea of tunneling is central to all of physics and is used to explain the properties of electronic devices, black holes, and the Big Bang. The universe itself might have been created via tunneling. By analogy, Gamow envisioned a prisoner sealed in a jail, surrounded by huge prison walls. In a classic Newtonian world, escape is impossible. But in the strange world of the quantum theory, you don't know precisely where the prisoner is at any point, or his velocity. If the prisoner bangs against the prison walls often enough, you can calculate the chances that one day he will pass right through them, in direct violation of common sense and Newtonian mechanics. There is a finite, calculable probability that he will be found outside the gates of the prison walls. For large objects like prisoners, you would have to wait longer than the lifetime of the universe for this miraculous event to happen. But for alpha particles and subatomic particles, it happens all the time, because these particles hit against the walls of the nucleus repeatedly with vast amounts of energy. Many feel that Gamow should have been given the Nobel Prize for this vitally important work. In the 1940s, Gamow's interests began to shift from relativity to cosmology, which he viewed as a rich, undiscovered country. All that was known about the universe at that time was that the sky was black and that the universe was expanding. Gamow was guided by a single idea: to find any evidence or fossils proving that there was a Big Bang billions of years ago. This was frustrating because cosmology is not an experimental science in the true sense of the word. There are no experiments one can conduct on the Big Bang. Cosmology is more like a detective story, an observational science where you can look for relics or evidence at the scene of the crime, rather than an experimental science where you can perform precise experiments. Nuclear Kitchen of the Universe. Gamow's next great contribution to science was his discovery of the nuclear reactions that gave birth to the lightest elements that we see in the universe. He liked to call it the prehistoric kitchen of the universe, where all the elements of the universe were originally cooked by the intense heat of the Big Bang. Today, this process is called nucleosynthesis, or calculating the relative abundances of the elements in the universe. Gamow's idea was that there was an unbroken chain, starting with hydrogen, that could be built by simply adding successively more particles to the hydrogen atom. The entire Mendeleev periodic chart of the chemical elements, he believed, could be created from the heat of the Big Bang. Gamow and his students reasoned that because the universe was an incredibly hot collection of protons and neutrons at the instant of creation, then perhaps fusion took place, with hydrogen atoms being fused together to produce helium atoms. As in a hydrogen bomb or a star, the temperatures are so hot that the protons of a hydrogen atom are smashed into each other until they merge, creating helium nuclei. Subsequent collisions between hydrogen and helium would, according to this scenario, produce the next set of elements, including lithium and beryllium. Gamow assumed that the higher elements could be sequentially built up by adding more and more subatomic particles to the nucleus. In other words, that all of the 100 or so elements that make up the visible universe were cooked in the fiery heat of the original fireball. In typical fashion, Gamow laid out the broad outlines of this ambitious program and let his PhD student, Ralph Alpher, fill in the details. When the paper was finished, he couldn't resist a practical joke. He put physicist Hans Bethe's name on the paper without his permission, and it became the celebrated Alpha-Beta-Gamma paper. What Gamow had found was that the Big Bang indeed was hot enough to create helium, which makes up about 25% of the universe by mass. Working in reverse, one proof of the Big Bang can be found by simply looking at many of the stars and galaxies of today and realizing that they are made of approximately 75% hydrogen, 25% helium, and a few trace elements. As David Spergel, an astrophysicist at Princeton, has said, "Every time you buy a balloon, you are getting atoms, some of which were made in the first few minutes of the Big Bang." However, Gamow also found problems with the calculation. His theory worked well for the very light elements, but elements with 5 and 8 neutrons and protons are extremely unstable and hence cannot act as a bridge to create elements that have a greater number of protons and neutrons. The bridge was washed out at 5 and 8 particles. Since the universe is composed of heavy elements with a great many more than 5 and 8 neutrons and protons, this left a cosmic mystery. The failure of Gamow's program to extend beyond the 5-particle and 8-particle gap remained a stubborn problem for years, dooming his vision for showing that all the elements of the universe were created at the moment of the Big Bang. Microwave background radiation. At the same time, another idea intrigued him. If the Big Bang was so incredibly hot, perhaps some of its residual heat is still circulating around the universe today. If so, it would give a fossil record of the Big Bang itself. Perhaps the Big Bang was so colossal